This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Stephen Robbins expected nothing more from the summer of 1917 than to continue to serve the guests at the Mountain Park Hotel, where he had worked since he was a young boy. But when the hotel was turned into a wartime German internment camp, Robbins had to take on a responsibility that he never expected. Thus begins A Short Time to Stay Here, a new novel from Chapel Hill-based author Terry Roberts. Terry Roberts grew up in Asheville, found out that the resort near his hometown had been used by the government during World War I, one that he had had an interest in, and made that the setting for his novel. Terry Roberts joins me in the studio now. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Frank, thank you so much. I'm a huge fan of you and this show, so it's a delight to be here.
It is a delight to have you, and I want to hear more about the historical part of this fiction. Tell us a little bit about the story of the resort itself. And
first of all, the resort hotel itself, the Mountain Park Hotel, it burned in 1920. Sometimes when people see an image or they read part of the novel, their first response is, can't I go stay there? Can't I get a weekend vacation package at the Mountain Park? I, of all people, would love to tell you it's true, but unfortunately that building hasn't been in existence since 1920. However, in 1917, it was one of the premier resort hotels in the entire East Coast. People forget that in the early 20th century, late 19th, early 20th century, that people still believed in the power of the medicinal hot springs. Right. They thought it would cure everything, as the saying used to be, from gout to syphilis. And so people would travel hundreds of miles to spend the summer in Hot Springs, North Carolina, and to soak in the medicinal hot springs. And that hotel was a focal point all up and down the East Coast. And so the Depression that preceded the First World War, because the rest of the world, of course, was embroiled in the war, most of Europe. And so that Depression led in turn to a decline in prosperity in America, which led in turn to fewer and fewer customers coming to Hot Springs. And so that resort hotel property became available just before America entered the war. And when they did, when America entered World War I, there were over 2,000 German nationals, primarily soldiers, rather sailors and merchant marine officers of ships that were in American harbors. So suddenly the U.S. government had 2,000 German nationals they didn't know what to do with. They weren't combatants, but they still had to put them somewhere, as it were, particularly to make the American populace feel safe. There was a lot of paranoia about saboteurs at large in the countryside. And so they chose this location in part because the hotel structure was already there, but also in part because it was extremely isolated in many ways. Other than the railroad, there was almost no traffic in and out of Western North Carolina in that era. And so by placing them there, they had a ready-made structure. They put a fence around it. And all of a sudden, they had these Germans in a safe place, as it were.
They weren't going to go anywhere. Tell us a little bit more about this. Fascinating. We didn't think that there were, at least I didn't think that there were interns and German interns during World War I. We knew there was some discrimination. Some had been arrested, et cetera. So were American officials, were they going onto these boats and pulling them off? Because they were going back and forth, right? I mean, otherwise they'd be leaving port and heading back to wherever.
Absolutely. Once America declared war, the ships themselves were interned. And it's interesting to note that at that point in history, one of these ships, the Vaterland, it was called, the Fatherland, was the largest ship in the world. It was the Titanic of its day. So these officers were very, very sophisticated men. They had sailed the world. They were used to being of service to the world's most sophisticated, most intelligent, richest people. So all of a sudden, they were the guests, as it were, of the United States government. And it's interesting to me, a kind of historical irony, that this fictional character, Stephen Robbins, who was used to being the manager of a resort hotel, now became, as it were, the host, and he calls himself this in chapter one, of these 2,000 Germans. Well, many of these Germans, not all, but many, were extraordinarily sophisticated, well-educated, cultured men from Europe primarily, who spoke multiple languages, who, as I had said before, traveled the world. All of a sudden, they were coexisting with, in a very isolated village on the French Broad River in western North Carolina, coexisting with the natives from that area, many of whom, say, for example, had never traveled more than 50 miles from home. My own family had lived in Madison County at that point since the 1700s. The only thing, as we used to say, that took us away from the cornfields was a war. So the Civil War, of course, took many people away, and they returned, most of them. And so all of a sudden you had this collision of cultures. Robert Morgan calls it a collision between two worlds. And that's one of the things that was most interesting to me about this.
And as you said, your family is from that area. When did you know about this story? Did you heard about this growing up?
I had heard about it growing up. My grandmother, who helped raise me, lived on the same property with myself and my parents, Sanders Court, near Weaverville, North Carolina. And occasionally, Grandma Roberts, as we would call her, got it into her head that we needed to go up home. And by up home, she meant down to Madison County, although it was north from where we were. And that meant we would visit Marshall, we would visit Hot Springs, she would visit her relatives. I've been told in later years that her visiting her brother meant that they had a beer together, although we didn't know that about Grandma Roberts back in the day. And so she went to visit the people she knew, but also the places she knew. And as a young boy, when I went along for the ride, people would say, that's where the German camp was. That's where the Germanies were, Germanies being the men themselves. And I had paid very little attention to it, although later in life, when I began to realize just how extraordinary an event this was, and in the larger world, nobody was aware of it. You didn't hear historians writing about it. You didn't hear people lecturing about it. But it was actually a pretty extraordinary event in our history.
So tell us about creating this, the character, Stephen mm-hmm. Robbins. Mm-hmm. Let's start with him.
Stephen Robbins is a runaway. The way he explains himself, from an isolated family in an isolated place, even for Madison County, a place called Anderson Cove. If there are any listeners right now in Madison County, they'll nod because they'll know immediately where Anderson Cove is. The rest of us, of course, don't. But Anderson Cove was a place that Stephen grew up. There is an episode, as he explains to a woman he eventually becomes involved with from his childhood, that caused him a good deal of guilt. And he ran away after his father's death to Hot Springs and went to work for Major Rumbo. Major Rumbo is based on a historical character, Jack Rumbo, who owned the Mountain Park Hotel. And he grew up, as it were, with a kind of second father in Major Rumbo, and eventually became quite well educated. He had learned to read in the one room schoolhouse in Anderson Cove, but Mrs. Rumbo, Carrie Rumbo, taught him to read using the books at Rutland, the Rumbo family home. So as he explains later, he was reading Jane Austen, he was reading Charles Dickens, he was reading John Donne, which comes into play at one point. Which was very unusual for a boy and then a man in his circumstances, but not that unusual. One of the misconceptions about people in Western North Carolina is that they don't value education the way other people do. My own family, for example, was manic. There's really no other word about education. Whatever it took, we would be educated. And so for Stephen to have this kind of background is unexpected, but not that unusual. And so he is the narrator of this novel. This is his story. He's in his late 40s when these events take place. He has been married, is now divorced, and he had lost a child to infant cholera. And so he's a troubled man. He may be an alcoholic when the events leading up to this story began. And so as he tells this story, in some ways this is about his own imprisonment and escape, as it were. So within the energy and the process and the story of his life, in a way, the same events are playing out as are playing out on a much larger level for thousands of other people.
And you create another character, Anna Ullman, who is loosely based on a real photographer, real-life photographer. Tell us about Anna.
Absolutely. Anna Ullman has a fictional first cousin, as it were, which is the historical photographer Doris Ullman, who is also from New York. Her photographs, both of folk ways, meaning local people making baskets, wood carving, weaving, are now famous. They're a part of our folk culture. One of the things that attracted me to Doris Ullman, and that I hope becomes evident in the novel itself, is that here was a woman in the early 20th century who had left, in my fictional character's case, left a marriage, a bad marriage, an abusive marriage in New York, and was paying her own way, quote unquote, with her craft, that of photography. And so not only was she exotic to Stephen and to other people in Western North Carolina because she was a native New Yorker, there's a wonderful little scene I like when she first arrives in Hot Springs and they load her luggage and her camera on the wagon, and the wagon drives away to her boarding house. The little boy who works at the railroad station turns to Stephen Robbins and says, "Uncle Stevie," and he says, "What?" And he says, "What's a camera?" And so there is this collision that's technological in a way as well as cultural. They meet, and I'm going to give away a little bit of a spoiler here. Eventually they become involved, and there is, I think, in the novel an energy that has always been important in terms of the mountains, in terms of Western North Carolina, that has to do with an insider-outsider perspective. Obviously, she's looking literally through the lens of a camera, but figuratively through the lens of her eyes, her education, her background. She sailed to Europe on these same ships that these Germans have brought to America. She's looking at Western North Carolina from that outsider perspective at the same time that Stephen Robbins is looking at it very much from an insider perspective. And so there's that tension between them personally that is also played out, I hope, in the novel in terms of how do we know who we are? Is it who we think we are, or is it who other people think we are?
Particularly when you reflect that against the even more exotic outsider, these German interns who are, as you say, sophisticated, educated, well-traveled, and now find themselves in the mountains of North Carolina.
Absolutely.
Will you read for us?
Please. Yeah, I'd love to. There's a passage now. Stephen and Anna have traveled to Asheville for a funeral. It's actually Major Rumbaugh's funeral, because Stephen has an interview with a representative from the War Department who is warning him about saboteurs, etc. They end up missing the evening train, and they're forced to spend the night in Asheville. And they have dinner at a historical place called the Sky Club. It wasn't in operation in 1917, but for our fictional purposes, it was. And this is one of the places where they're sort of fencing back and forth between their personalities. They don't quite yet know what to make of each other. "I'll tell you the truth now," I said eventually. This is Stephen in first person. "To pay you back for earlier," when she had told him an equally revealing thing about herself. "But you better brace yourself. This is an ugly truth." "Ugly to tell or ugly to hear?" she asks. "Both, I imagine, based on what it does to me to talk about it. When I was 10 years old, my father took sick with pneumonia and died up home in Anderson Cove. February of 1885, black cold and a skiff of snow on the ground. One day he was working his full stint, nursing a cold with a ragged cough, but nothing to scare you. The next day he was in bed complaining that his chest hurt, and the day after he couldn't get up without help. That night he was delirious, and my mother sent me for the doctor in Marshall." "You were 10? I nodded. "How far was it?" 6 or 7 miles there and the same back, on horseback. I rode up and over the divide, down through Bearwalla Gap to the river, across the bridge at Barnard, and then down the turnpike to Marshall. "Didn't we go through Marshall this morning on the train?" I nodded again. "Barnard and Marshall both. The problem is I got lost. The great problem of my life is I got lost in the snow and the dark when I came to the gap of the mountain. I went the wrong way for most of a mile and had to backtrack. And even then I was confused. Something no mountain boy should ever be. Something I should never have been, even on the darkest night. So it took me 2 hours longer than it should have. When I finally found the doctor's house, it was past midnight. And by the time I got to the doctor back to the cove, it was dawn." "What happened?" "He died during the night. He managed to hold on till an hour or so before first light, the coldest part of the night, before he let go." "You were just a boy," she said. "Doesn't matter. I failed him. So it seemed to me then, so it seems to me now. It was years ago, but I'm still on that horse, scared to death, riding in the black dark and snow in my face. 2 hours wouldn't have made a difference." "Maybe. But I was just a kid, Anna, and for years after, I was convinced that everyone blamed me. My face goes numb just talking about it. But nobody really blamed. I was the oldest son." She paused, considering. "And so you've been taking care of people ever since." "It seems so," I said, overcome then by the sadness of it all. Maybe when I die, I can get off that horse. Maybe the sun will rise. She did something then. Rather than trying to say something where there was no place for words, she did something. Before the passive waiter standing by the door to the kitchen and before God, she got up, placed her napkin carefully beside her plate, and walked around the table. She pulled me from my chair and hugged me. I was hot to sweating, at a loss for breath. And now it was she who felt like a stream of cool air.
Terry Roberts reading from his soon-to-be-released novel, A Short Time to Stay Here. Novel will be out in September. Set in the mountains of North Carolina, this book is about the identity of individuals, the identity of a place like the mountains, seen against these, as you say, the exotic kind of German interns. And the other thing is the fears that these folks are dealing with, that what we're supposed to be afraid of is the saboteurs, the Germans. They don't speak our language. They're our enemy. And yet his deepest fear, the deepest anxiety and the enemy for him is right inside his own mind.
That's exactly right. Thank you so much. I think this is a novel about one way I think about this novel is that it's a novel for adults, meaning it's about people who have lived long enough to know what their own fears are, what their own the patterns of their own lives could possibly be if they're fortunate enough. And it is, in a sense, about imprisonment and escape, as we said earlier, both for us as individuals and then also for us as societies. How do we learn to escape our fears so that we don't go to war? And how do we learn how to escape our fears so that we understand eventually how to live together?
And know what we're projecting on others and know what, you know, and to find out where the source of this kind of scary light that we're shining on the rest of the world. Wonderful concept, great book. But did you think, which came first? Has this idea been rattling about in you for a long time? Or did you have to get a novel out about this exotic, this cool place that Grandma took you to?
That's right. I think, well, first of all, the adult Terry Roberts struggles with these characters, and the characters are a man and a woman, both of whom have passed, have lived full lives, lives that have caused them some pain. And part of that understanding or that realization is that this is both a war story and a love story. And when the war comes along, it creates the circumstances, I believe, where they no longer have to do business as usual. In fact, they're almost forced on a personal level not to do business as usual. You can imagine Anna Ullman, who's married to a well-known and wealthy Freudian therapist in New York, continuing her life unabated, and it's a life of privilege. It's a life of luxury in many ways. You can imagine, as you said earlier, Frank, Stephen Robbins would continue the pattern of his life as the manager of this wonderful resort hotel, in which he has been, in his own mind, in the mind of others, very successful. But the war changes all of that. And because of that, circumstances are such that they now have the opportunity to redefine themselves and remake themselves. And they discover in each other, I think, a helpmate, if you will, in terms of that redefinition and that re-understanding of who they are.
Terry, great pleasure talking with you. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you so much, Frank.
Terry Roberts' new novel, A Short Time to Stay Here, it's going to be out in September, but you can pre-order and get more information if you go to the website, ashorttimetostayhere.com. Coming up just ahead, we'll explore the North Carolina roots of a journalism pioneer. Stay with us on The State of Things.